Today on the Monocle Weekly, Edition 79, we'll be getting a roundup on Asia-Pacific geopolitics following this week's G20 and APEC summits.
The smaller middle-range Asian countries are not looking to replace the dominance of America with the dominance of China. They want to be able to map this G20 world in a way that they have more options than one.
That was Nader Moussavizadeh from Oxford Analytica. We'll also be hearing more about the winner of the prestigious Chatham House Annual Prize for International Diplomacy.
Over the last 4 or 5 years, Turkey has really gained a lot of prominence in the international media, in think tanks, in universities, and amongst the political elites.
That was Fadi Hakura, Associate Fellow at Chatham House. And later, we'll be talking to Michael O'Malley, Executive Editor at Yale University Press, about his book, Revealing What Bees Can Teach Us, about running successful businesses.
They do all the things that we do. They eat, they sleep, they work, they care for their young, they provide shelter. Certainly somewhere in here are some lessons that we can learn.
And now from London, the Monocle Weekly with Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound.
Hello, it's November 14th, 2010. And you're with the Monocle Weekly here in London. I'm Tyler Brulé, along with Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound. And I didn't say it's Sunday, just in case people didn't know what day this program goes out. It's Sunday.
It is Sunday.
It is.
Phew.
It felt like it.
Yeah.
I thought it was.
And I want to break the suspense as well. I just want to get this out of the way at the top of the program, because if anyone is wondering if you won the International Diplomacy Prize from Chatham House, you didn't, Andrew.
Oh.
I know.
I thought I'd got...
You lobbied quite hard, didn't you? Yeah. You put a lot of business cards. You went around on your bikes, didn't you, with your business cards?
And I've eased relations
all the embassies.
Office,
yeah. Yeah. Sorry. Sorry about that. We'll be talking to Fadi Hakura later in the program about that.
I look forward to speaking to him.
About Andrew's lack of success.
Exactly. Yeah.
Why I'm not on the chalkboard.
Special appendix program. Look what I brought. I brought some treats for my travels. Do you want one?
Which nation are these from?
These are from, well, they're from Switzerland. So if we're going to have chocolates on
Did
a Sunday morning.
Buy them? Yeah. They weren't given to you on a plane.
They weren't given to me on a plane.
Yeah. They were. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay, Rob, you first.
I thought that was a Terminal 5
rude.
Promotional ribbon.
No, they weren't.
I'm joking.
No.
Thank you very
they're
much.
They're from Geneva.
Yum.
So you go to the different end of the box. I'm going for the white chocolate.
You've gone okay.
For, you've gone
dark.
For dark.
I like dark.
Yeah.
I'm going to abstain.
Okay.
You can't not have one.
You know why?
Why?
Because we've got a TV show coming up.
Oh. Nice.
I know. We're starting our TV show on Bloomberg.
Did that come from the chocolates, that plug?
It did. Oh. Is that good? And I'm going to stay away. I'm going to put them over here. Actually, you should stay away from them too, because you're both going to be on the program. premiere date, December 18th. Monocle on Bloomberg Television.
I know, it's very exciting.
I was working on the set design this week.
We were actually hammering and nailing away.
Yeah,
I was. It's going to have sort of a, yeah, we're going to sort of build a front stoop. There's going to be a lot of a red brick theme.
Nice.
There might be some intellectual property issues with Sesame Street, I thought. But
well,
anyway.
Well, who's going to be inside the Elmo puppet?
Who's going to be in the trash can being the Grouch? That would have been me earlier in the week. I was in a very good mood when I came into London on Tuesday. Do you ever have those days when you could punch somebody? Or do you have them all the time?
No, I'm quite good in the office. I haven't punched anyone yet.
Oh. Depends on how long people keep you cooped up in the bin there, Andrew, doesn't it?
Exactly.
That's really the problem. I thought the show was going to have I thought the set design for the show might be maybe like a big ship.
Mm. And what would happen on the ship?
Well, you'd be dressed as a captain.
Of course.
And that would be sort of obvious. We'd change it for different
types
of transport.
We were looking
program.
At different things. But the great thing is there's lots of sort of activity areas on the set of this program, which is good. And I'm very excited about it. Well, no, it's great doing the Monocle Weekly, and we get to talk to people, you know, down the line, whether they're on a phone line or they're in a studio down an ISDN line. We're going to have satellites.
That's pretty nice.
I know,
isn't
satellites
it?
Are great. I don't think people use satellites enough anymore. I mean, we've complained about it from time to time in the magazine that too much of television is just someone sitting in their pants on Skype now on CNN.
I know, and then they switch the camera on by accident with their knee.
Exactly.
No. You get an up crotch shot.
That, and also, yeah, I think it's true, because a lot of people have it balanced on their knee, so there's just a lot of nostril TV now.
There is a lot.
And so I say bring back, well, we are bringing back the satellite.
And the good thing about that is you get a clear picture of it as well.
You do get a clear picture, and also it saves you having to sort of go to the cookery section of the show, or the DIY section.
Exactly. No, so there's going to be lots of different activity areas as well. You've got some chocolate on your lip.
Well, am I going to be in the cookery area?
You might be, but not with chocolate on your lip like that. Definitely not. Also, I'm very excited because one of the main things is that we spend a bit of time on other television networks, and also Bloomberg has very good hair and makeup, which is important. They have what is it called? I mean, it's some kind of shellac that they put on their presenters' hairs.
Oh, really?
Not hair. I want some of that.
Like a sort of
Do you like Betty Lou?
Betty Lube. Is that another product that comes in?
Yeah, that's another product. Betty Lou.
I don't know.
It's L-I-U.
Oh, yes.
Yes. And she's got fantastic hair on Bloomberg.
There is some decent...
Because it's sort of shellac, but it has bounce.
Yeah, that's what you need.
We could do that with yours, I think.
Well, we need... Okay, all right. So it's sort of a hard outer shell with a sort of inner volume and body.
Something like that.
Okay, that's good. I'm practice turning right. Letting it wash over my face.
Speaking of Betty Lou, I was in Hong Kong. How's that segue? I was in Hong Kong and I was in Seoul and I was in... we were chatting the other line when I was in Japan as well.
And you went to see our lovely Liv in the Hong Kong office?
I saw lovely Liv, who pulled me out on a shopping expedition because they're missing a few things. Liv wanted a new carpet. So we had to go shopping for a new rug for Liv. Speaking of Bloomberg, then I had a very nice dinner with Mayor Bloomberg. Not just me and the mayor. It was about 16 other people there.
Was his opening salvo? So about this show.
Exactly.
I don't like the nautical theme type.
Yeah, he didn't, I know. So that's why he sort of killed it. But that's why he wanted the sort of the red brick and the stoop theme. And I said, Mayor, I said, listen, we can't do the New York thing out of London. And I said, we'll have some IP rights with Sesame Street. You wouldn't want to mess with them.
So you've got a sort of stucco Georgian frontage.
Exactly.
You walk out the door every morning.
Anyway, the mayor was there to take over the helm, looking after the C-40. And there was a big summit there. As you know, we were talking to Christine Lowe last week. And how is this for crazy? From Lou to Lowe? I arrive at dinner, remember, because on last week's show we were chatting to her. Who's sitting beside me at dinner? Christine Lowe.
Nice.
Wow.
Incredible, no?
Serendipity.
Yeah. Sean. Yeah. And then she talked about how much her family, all of her family, loves the magazine. But she never said she liked it. Yeah, she does.
I know.
Yeah, that was sort of later, but
she likes
it. Yeah. Anyway, we should probably stay in Asia because it's been a big week for Asia.
Is this going to be another segue? Is this going to be another
C40, G20?
Okay.
APEC in Yokohama. And that means, Andrew, over to you, because I believe you've been chatting to someone about what's been happening all over the Pacific Rim this week.
Yes. Earlier in the week, I caught up with Nada Muzavizadeh of Oxford Analytica. And I talked to him about the power play that's taking place in Asia Pacific. And this is what he had to say. Well, Nada, thanks for joining us. First of all, it would just be interesting to get your opinion about the G20 actually being hosted this time in Seoul by the Koreans. Does that kind of reflect, you know, a general shift of power? People want to see these events take place more often in Asia?
I think it does, and I think what you're seeing is actually global structures catching up with where power has already shifted to. Rather than necessarily reflecting a shift in power. I think you're seeing a number of middle powers, Korea being one of them, that both have important economic interests and influence in the world, as well as strong national security and security interests. Obviously, the North is a big preoccupation for them. But I think what you're seeing is that the global institutions, whether it's the World Bank or the UN, are not able to match their universal legitimacy with effectiveness, and people want to go to where things get done. And are increasingly looking to institutions like the G20. The downside or the risk, what you're seeing, is that as power is more concentrated in a group like the G20, the real issues, the real distinctions where people really have differences also come to the fore more quickly.
And for a country like Korea, it's obviously expensive things to host something like the G20, not just the security issues, but the whole apparatus that goes with it. What do they get out of being a successful host of something like G20?
Well, I think the first thing to get out is that their own profile, their own position as a middle power to be reckoned with is confirmed, both for political reasons as well as economic reasons. Korea as a country is one that, whether you look at something like the G20 or some of the green growth, renewable resources initiatives that they're taking, are trying very much to match what is a very dynamic business sector with growing recognition. And this is also something to do with having a very dynamic president right now, who, of course, comes from a business background. And I think out of all that, Korea wants to have more of a say globally, but also be able to match its interests in Asia, both looking to China as well as obviously its strong alliance with America.
And how effective can these countries be at kind of changing the debate in Asia at the moment? We all know that the power of China, you know, militarily, economically, on every count, what they say really has to go in Asia, it feels, on many days. Do the Koreans and do the other kind of people meeting at G20 have a chance to kind of try and make the kind of the debate in Asia a bit more diverse? You know, we've seen Obama there, we've seen the British Prime Minister go there, all just trying to say, look, we know China dominates here, but please try and listen to us and please try and do some business with us. As much as the G20 does, can it really kind of change that debate?
I think they can. I think what you're seeing with the events in Asia broadly over the last 6 to 8 weeks, whether it's some of the border disputes that you and I have talked about, whether it's the India visit of Obama, whether it's the Chinese disputes with Vietnam and other countries on some of the territorial issues, it's a terrific lesson in the kind of physics of geopolitics. And what you're seeing, I think very importantly, as much as Asia has no alternative but to see it rise alongside the much more dramatic rise of China, if the United States and other Western longstanding powers in the region play their cards right, what's clear is that the smaller middle-range Asian countries are not looking to replace the dominance of America with the dominance of China. They want to have alternatives. They want to be able to map this G20 world in a way that they have more options than one. And I think for Asia more generally, whether it's Korea or actually Singapore, as importantly, people are looking to venues, to geographies that are not China and not the United States, where people can come a little bit on neutral ground and discuss economic interests or political interests. And I think that is another reason why countries like Singapore and Korea actually will see more and more opportunity to influence events and be, if nothing else, a neutral ground or a broker of interests.
It's fascinating what you say about the smaller countries, because what seems very interesting over the last couple of years is also the rise of places like Vietnam. We now have kind of oil and gas wealth. We've seen this new acronym, the Civit Nations, which includes Indonesia and Vietnam. Mm-hmm. They seem to have a bit of power now that people, it's almost taken people by surprise. And you see diplomatic missions rather late, belatedly trying to catch up with, you know, these countries. Again, do you see the kind of shifting there of power in Asia as these smaller nations rise?
I think you do. I think, again, it's very hard to overestimate the present and future influence of China. I think it's got to be the starting point everywhere. But, you know, if you combine economic interests, natural resources that these places are either have or are discovering more and more, and obviously a country like Indonesia, given the size it has and given the influence it has in the region anyway, will continue to find opportunities. And again, there will be a space that's going to be, I think, going to grow between the strong dominance of the United States, which much of the region doesn't want, and the strong dominance of China, which much of the region doesn't want either. And if they can play their cards right, they will, I think, match their economic and political power. And the other thing I think you're seeing is that people are exploring new models of governance. Again, much as they don't want to exchange American dominance with Chinese dominance, they don't necessarily want to have to choose between the American model or the Chinese model. People are developing their own models that suit them more. This is very much consistent with an image of an archipelago world, one that you and I have talked about before, of a, you know, broader distribution of power, idea, and capital with multiple models that work to the interests of specific countries. And that can have everything to do with how they manage trade, how they manage their currency, how they manage their political and economic relations, where you're going to see just a proliferation of models that, again, are enabled by the rising power of these countries. So they don't just have to pick either the Chinese or American model.
The country we haven't really mentioned in all of this is Japan, you know, still the world's third biggest economy, sits right at the heart of Asia-Pacific, but doesn't seem to be always the most effective at getting its voice heard. And still, you know, all these years after the Second World War, seems to still manage to kind of stir up rivalries and you know, antagonisms from all the way back then. As you said, we've seen the Medvedev go to the Kuril Islands, which are disputed with Japan. There's border and maritime disputes with Vietnam, with their friends supposedly in South Korea. Does it surprise you that Japan isn't more effective at getting its voice heard? And is there a place at the table for it?
I think there is a place at the table of Japan, but I think there's no question that for the Japanese, this is a moment that has quite significant challenges. I think the principal concern of Japan is China and the relative shift in power between the two of them. And as they look over the horizon for demographic and other reasons, they've got to be concerned about what's happening there. I would hope that the Japanese actually are looking to poorer, less developed countries that are emerging quickly, whether it's, you know, Korea or Indonesia or some of the others, that are actually showing the way in forging an independent identity between the two. Because otherwise, Japan, I think, for all these historical reasons that you mentioned, is going to have a hard time to find a place at the table. And the difficulty it has in emerging from its economic trough will only be exacerbated, certainly as a relative basis, if you look elsewhere in the region. So I would hope that Japan, in a way, looks at its neighborhood and feels that it's a spur to engaging more dynamically on its own.
Both the G20 and APEC, a lot of the talk has been about protectionism and about creating more bilateral kind of trading relations and making sure that those are kept open at a time when there does seem to be a kind of tendency for lots of these countries to begin to start building walls around themselves. They're unsure about how their economies are going to fare with, you know, currency fluctuations, with, you know, trade with mighty China. Is that a cause both of, you know, potential risk for the world economy, but also do you think in bigger terms, you know, that those could be actual wars and mini battles being lined up there?
I'm skeptical that the tensions that we see now would lead to actual conflict between these Asian countries. They have way too much at stake from an economic and trade term perspective. What I think you are likely to see, and these are the risks, are really three kinds of protectionism: trade protectionism, investment protectionism, and then currency protectionism, which is, in other words, for some of the devaluation and competitive devaluation we're seeing among the broader markets. I think the real challenge for the global economy and for those who have championed a free market, open trade system for very long is that it's becoming harder and harder for some of these middle powers to justify having bought into a free trade system and an open economy system that in many ways seems to them skewed to the advantage of the big powers, whether it's the Chinese on the currency front, whether it's the U.S. on the trade front and with its own, obviously, currency impact of its own quantitative easing. What you're seeing there, I think, is more and more of a question for countries. You know, maybe we should have currency controls. Maybe, in fact, that is the right answer for us, given the risk to our own currency from uncontrolled flows of investments, given the interest rate differential between developed and developing markets. Maybe we do need to protect our industries in ways we haven't before. Then they will look to markets that otherwise claim to be purely free and open, and they will find examples where they're not, whether the United States bailing out its own auto industry, whether it's the Chinese with the various means they have of supporting their state-owned entities. I think the reality is, away from the rhetoric, that lots of countries have set up ways in which they are trying to encourage or protect their own industries. And so what I see is a trend more towards a messier, more complicated set of arrangements between countries that doesn't fit one model either of strict protectionism or completely open trade, but one where more and more countries will find that bilateral arrangements are what serve their economic interests, or regional arrangements, but one that doesn't necessarily fit the model of, you know, a universal trade agreement.
So if you, finally, just looking ahead at what will happen over the coming years, do you think that means it's a much, much more complicated game for Western governments, for if you're sitting in Washington, you just can't rely on the old networks of diplomacy to kind of get your way, that you're going to have to work much harder on the ground? And it's interesting, it comes at a time when, you know, many governments in Europe are pulling back embassy staff. They're not sure they have the money to kind of fund missions. It's an interesting time if they need to have more diverse people on the ground, more a bigger network, that they're, you know, that we're pulling out just at the time when we should be kind of expanding.
No question. And I think the risk there is that not only can you say are Western governments pulling out when they should be expanding, one way they're trying to compensate for that is to make their foreign policy much more trade focused. You see that with the UK, you see that with other economies. You see, you know, Obama goes to Asia and all he says that the trip is about is jobs. Cameron the same, going to China. But the other thing that you're seeing is that this retrenchment from a diplomatic perspective, somewhat balanced by more focus on trade, is happening at the very time where certainly the Chinese are deploying many, many more resources in diplomatic terms in lots of the interesting kind of markets of opportunity, where increasingly, I think if you go to a place like Central Asia, you'll find that it's the Chinese diplomats who actually understand what's going on in these countries better than anyone, better than the Western governments, better than the Russians even. And you're just going to see a world where the nexus of politics and economics is going to be more and more decisive to getting trade or economic advantage. And therefore, you need more resources understanding those issues and not fewer. So it'll be a time where, for Western governments, they have to allocate resources very, very closely to making sure that they can compete in these markets.
And probably forget about raising all those issues about human rights for a little while.
I think that's likely to be the case.
Nada Muzavizadeh, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Andrew.
You're back with the Monarch Weekly here in London. This week, Chatham House awarded its prestigious annual prize recognizing the statesperson who they deem made the most significant contribution to improving international relations during the course of the year. President Abdullah Gül of Turkey seized the award, joining a list of notable past winners that include former presidents Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva of Brazil and the Ukraine's Viktor Yushchenko. We're joined by Fadi Hakoura, associate fellow at Chatham House, on the line to hear more about why President Gül was chosen for the victory and to find out who else was in the running for the prize this year. Hello, Mr. Hakoura.
Hello.
I mean, to start, there is, obviously, when we look at this, there's been some, quite serious winners. Brazil's President da Silva, the winner last year. Who was in the running for 2010?
For 2010, we had the French finance minister, Christine Lagarde, for her contributions to stemming the global economic crisis. And we had also the former president of Croatia, who, for his contributions to resolving the problems and the insecurities in the Balkan region.
Mm. I mean, obviously, these were the three finalists. But when Chatham House is looking at the total global field, you know, how many are on the original shortlist? Are you starting with, a group of 20, taking it down to 10, then to get to Ms. Lagarde and Mr. Message and then Mr. Gül?
What normally happens is that at Chatham House, people nominate individual names for this prize. And then we have a panel of three senior politicians. One is Lord Ashdown from the Liberal Democrats, Sir John Major from the Conservative Party, and Lord Robertson from the Labour Party. Then whittle them down to three or four nominees. Mm.
So how close was it, would you say? Obviously, if we look across 2009 and certainly 2010, it was very much a time that that Ms. Lagarde, I think, really rose to prominence. I mean, and certainly not just within a European context, but within a global context. So how close was the race?
Well, what happens is that the final award is done by the membership of Chatham House. So after the three nominees are presented to our membership, they get to vote. And this year, the majority voted for President Gül of Turkey. Mm.
What would you say were, and of course, we have to sort of look at, all people who have the power to cast a ballot within Chatham House. I would imagine, knowing the UK's position generally on Turkey, wanting to pull Turkey much closer, into Europe, obviously that's been very much the mission of Mr. Gül as well. Is this also very much a political statement, really from a global level, that Chatham House also wants the world to recognize a Turkey that should certainly be closer in the European fold?
Over the last 4 or 5 years, Turkey has really gained a lot of prominence in the international media, in think tanks, in universities, and amongst the political elites of Europe, United States, and around the world, for its growing role in the Middle East, with Russia, on issues such as critical issues such as energy security, as well as Turkey's contributions to NATO forces in Afghanistan, as well as the UN peacekeeping forces in southern Lebanon. Mm. So for all those reasons, I think Turkey has been gaining a much greater profile, and not too dissimilar, for example, from Brazil under President da Silva in the past few years.
Do you think there's no question, obviously, we've seen the rise of Turkey economically, but of course, as you're highlighting more just, Turkey geopolitically as well. When Chatham House, obviously gives an award like this, is it also slightly looking over the horizon as well, that this is saying that, everyone who perhaps wasn't paying as close attention needs to do so as well? I mean, obviously, there's a timing, this comes at the end of the year. And I'm wondering sort of what type of wind you see in the sails of Turkey moving forward.
If we look at, for example, the current policies of the coalition government in the United Kingdom, we can see that the current government, as well as the previous Labour government, put a lot of emphasis to increase Britain's outreach to the rising powers in the East, for example, Brazil, China, India, and Turkey being one of them, not only for geopolitical reasons, but also, as you mentioned, to drum up jobs, investment, as well as in the United Kingdom. So for all those reasons, it is not surprising that Turkey's growing profile, both economic and political profile, is increasingly being recognized around the world, including in the United Kingdom.
Mm. And Mr. Kerr, I'm not really sure if Chatham House has a crystal ball or not, but if you could look forward, do you think that Turkey is going to be able to manage to chart this secular course at this point? Because obviously we've seen the rise of certainly more conservative elements of Islam.
There are concerns that social conservatism is growing quite a lot in Turkey, and those opinions are growing, not just in Europe, but also in the United States. There is evidence, of course, that Turkey is charting its own course, that Turkey is a Muslim-majority country, that the pious populations of Anatolia are now consolidating power in Turkey at the expense of the so-called Kemalists, the secularists who have been running Turkey since modern Turkey was created in 1923.
Does Turkey have an opportunity right now to certainly, yeah, set an example, be a benchmark, call it what you will, for the rest of the region, saying that of course, you know, we are able to embrace the more conservative elements of Islam, but at the same time, you know, we can also put forward a face which is that of a secular one, which is you know, is going to be right, you know, as the nation looks not just to Europe but to many other parts of the rest of the world from an economic perspective, but also in terms of a strategic perspective as well.
To some extent, Turkey does serve as an example for the region. But on the other hand, also there is an irony here that the Turkish democratic system has allowed a more pious, more conservative party to assume power and prominence in Turkey. And that, I think, may deter some of the countries in the Middle East, like in Egypt, to allow, which is trying to put controls, limits on more religious parties from assuming power in Turkey. So to some extent, yes, for some countries, but for others like Egypt, Turkey may provide a counterexample of not promoting a pluralistic system of government.
Great. Fatih Hakura, Associate Fellow at Chatham House, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly from London. We're back in a moment. Back with The Monarch Weekly here in London, where it's time for culture with Robert Bound. Rob, guess who I bumped into in Seoul?
Oh, was it Bernie Cho?
It was Bernie Cho. Uh-huh. We hosted a little cocktail party at the Park Hyatt. Have you been to the bar in the basement?
Is that where the karaoke joint is?
No, that's at the Grand Hyatt.
Oh.
And I've never been to that karaoke. Have you been to that karaoke joint?
Yeah, well, I went around it, but not with...
You wouldn't perform without
it. Not with my lungs out.
No.
Exactly.
But it's called the Timber House, and so they've recreated a traditional Korean house in the basement of the Park Hyatt. Right. But we were pulling together the guest list, and someone who works for the Shinsegae group said, oh, there's someone who you know really well who's coming to the party, Bunny Choi. I said, I don't know any Bunny Choi's, but she sounds like fun.
Yes, doesn't she?
And as much as I like Bernie Cho, that's what it was. I was kind of disappointed.
Damn, you were thinking of some sort of feisty Korean girl.
That's what I thought, yeah.
You know, in a kind of baby doll.
Yeah,
yeah.
She might have gone to Brown and she...
Yeah, that kind.
But yeah, there were no fluffy ears or tail or anything. It was just
Bernie.
It was just Bernie.
Bernie,
but it was good, though.
Form, though.
And there was... it was... And we went to this... I don't know if you've been to this bar, this magazine bar, which is...
Yes. Yeah.
Andrew, amazing, amazing. This is what we'll all do sort of later in life when we're not creating a magazine of our own. This guy's created this bar in Seoul, and he's a complete magazine addict, and it is just lined, you know, probably 80 copies deep of everything from French glamour from the 1980s, the first time around when it came out, to old copies of Face, Blitz, of course, our magazine, but just, I mean, all kinds of titles, like old copies of Casa Brutus from Japan, etc. And then he's just playing, he's working the bar, it's just him, he's working the bar, he's also spinning his vinyl and everything else that's there. And it was just great. And then Bernie and some of his friends, they just called up a bibimbap delivery joint, and we had bibimbap delivered to the restaurant.
Nice.
And
is he selling the magazines, or is it
a
shop?
Yeah. You can buy the magazines as well. It was a very good experience. It was a good new discovery.
And the menu, the drinks menu, the cocktail menu is mad, isn't it? Whether you looked at the menu, whether you just...
We never got that far. It's the champagne
hilariously
rolling
written.
In.
Yeah. It's kind of like, he does all these cheeky cocktails with weird names and then writes in massive capital letters with sort of 14 exclamation marks, for surprising result. After you're like, well, I'll have two of those. it's a brilliant, it's one of the best bars I've ever been to.
I like Seoul more and more.
Yeah.
It's a good town. Mm. You've never been, have you?
I've never been, but everyone who's been just says it's so big and so spread out that it does take a few times before you kind of know where to go and it begins to make any sense to you as an outsider.
Okay, Bunny Choi, what do you have for us?
I've got something from Spain for us today.
Okay.
Well, it was getting a bit cold, wasn't it, this week?
It was getting cold. Well, it wasn't that cold in Hong Kong, but anyway.
The Crystal Fighters are from Navarra. They're from the Basque Country.
Navarra?
Navarra.
Mm-hmm.
You say Navarra, I say Navarra. And this track is you might like this. I think this is more Sundish, more in the vein of old, bit of electro.
Mm. What would I be having with this if you know if we were in our little country place in Navarra right now? Would there be sort of a plate of jamon? We would be having.
There could be a plate of jamon, but I think also you might have a
tortilla,
a mirabol.
Oh really?
Also spinning at
already?
The same time. Yeah, it's kind of you know brunch meets disco.
Here we go. I did like that very much.
Good, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great record.
I like all the strings.
Yeah.
It would make you happy, I think, that.
It does make... Is it making you happy now?
Yeah, it is. Put a smile on my face.
You happy?
Yeah, I'm happy.
Aww.
All cheered up now.
Brilliant.
And I thought that maybe... I'm going on a bit of a limb here, but there were sort of shades, just because of all the strings, I thought there were sort of shades of Fernando.
What, ABBA?
Yeah.
It was a bit.
I was thinking, where is this going in the beginning?
There's a bit of plucking.
Yeah,
a lot of plucking. And then you get a nice little wodge of bass in there.
Yeah.
It's really good. And the album is excellent as well. It's called Star of Love, Crystal Fighters.
And what else do we know about them?
I don't know. Well, I think two of them are of Basque origin in New York and two of them are in Navarra.
But they're based in Spain, we believe.
Well, they're sort of based halfway through. You know how people are these days.
Where's that, the Azores?
Yes, exactly.
Out in the Canaries?
They're recorded on a ship. No one knows where they are.
Do you think we have the Monocle Winter Series coming up as well? Have we plugged enough brand extensions today?
We've got Monocle Winter Series.
Yeah.
We've got TV. We've got Moving Office. That's another discussion.
Well, Moving Office. We won't talk about that today. No. We'll save that for another show.
Monocle Alpino.
The whole show, packing tips. Yeah.
Alpino.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
A Monocle Alpino. But with the Monocle Winter Series, we could probably sort of talk about some of our guests in the coming weeks. But Bernie Cho, we're going to be bringing maybe a Korean act or two. To keep things wintersy and cozy.
Yeah, that'd be quite nice.
Yeah.
There are some good ones out there. Did Bernie dig into his iPod?
Have you ever been...
Come on.
Have you ever been cozy in Korea?
I have, got fairly cozy.
Just wanted to see. It's just going to work for the winter series, that's all. You have to get into character. I've also told them that they have to also sing a carol.
Oh, wow, that's going to be excellent.
Good, no?
Yeah.
I'm just want to evolve the program.
Well, we've got a bit of a Korean Christmas theme in the...
We do in the magazine. Yeah. God, this is the show of segues.
Yeah. Christmas with a K.
If only it was sponsored by them.
Exactly. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We're back in a moment. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly. A new book out this week in the UK looks to nature for inspiration on running a successful business. The Wisdom of Bees, What the Hive Can Teach Business About Leadership, Efficiency and Growth, is based on the author's experiences and observations after taking up beekeeping as a hobby and focuses around a back-to-basics approach to increasing efficiency. Joining us now in the studio to reveal all is the author, Dr. Michael O'Malley, who is also executive editor at Yale University Press and adjunct professor at the Columbia Business School in New York. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
I first saw the book at JFK. I believe it was in the Hudson's bookseller in the BA terminal, probably midsummer. Had a very good display, by the way.
Very good.
And when I looked at it, and I did pick it up, and I will admit I didn't buy it because I knew that we'd probably be speaking at this point in November and I'd get a free press copy. But what was the inspiration? I mean, you know, obviously, there was the observational side, but how long did it take you? Was it really an epiphany in the garden saying, right, there is absolutely a business book in this right away? How did it come about?
Well, you know, we got our bees about 12 years ago, and I put a bench in front of the hive, and I started observing them. And at first, it was chaotic and incomprehensible, and I started reading for about 5 years everything there is to be read about bees. And suddenly, I saw patterns and meaning in their behavior, and I thought, you know, surely they do all the things that we do. They eat, they sleep, they work, they care for their young, they provide shelter. Certainly somewhere in here are some lessons that we can learn. I mean, they have existed for over 100 million years, so they're, as a species, very successful. So that got me interested.
Do you think you would have spent another 5 years on the bench that you would have been able to identify those patterns on your own without having to research it?
No, because I would have had to open up the hive. I would have been stung repeatedly. And no, the research actually was instrumental in knowing what to look for within the hive when I opened up the hive.
Well, we're going to come back to the nitty-gritty of getting stung a little bit later because it really sort of begs the question. So where do you take us then on this journey? So you look at the patterns and how there is a complete and very industrious society in and around the hive. How do you bring this into a modern context, and particularly a 2010, let's try to get ourselves back in shape narrative anyway?
Well, first of all, there are 25 lessons in the book, but if I were to condense them down to a few sort of meta principles that I think are key for the survival of honeybees, one is, of course, they have a common goal. And if I can anthropomorphize just a bit, they trust each other. So when a bee communicates with another bee, they don't question it. They actually follow one another. They protect the future at all costs, so they do not succumb to short-termism. So if they found a lucrative vein of nectar, they don't all flock to that one spot. They always keep an exploratory force out looking for the next new thing. And I think the one thing that would surprise people is that, you know, you think of the queen and that she rules the colony, but she does very little. Daily decisions from taking out the trash to foraging are all made locally by workers according to local cues and communications with other bees. It is an empowered organization. It's completely decentralized.
Mm. I mean, when you explained it there, and I don't know what you think, but a lot of countries, well, not a lot, a couple of countries come to mind, and certainly a few companies. As you take the reader through the book, do you actually cite examples of, from the international corporate landscape, or certainly if we look at other nations that are organized in this way?
Diversity, for instance, is a very major element for the hive in protecting themselves against undue risk. And the idea is, well, diversity in the hive is introduced through genetic diversity through multiple fathers. But companies like Novozymes, I quote in there, and they tend to hire entrepreneurs, people who are a little bit different, have, you know, interesting hobbies, they're curious. So that's how they introduce diversity. And the benefit in the hive is that the bees are more sensitive to a greater array of cues. And so they, for instance, forage from a broader territory. They will visit more and varied flowers. So the whole idea of diversity is to actually expand the options that you have. So the more the diverse the hive, the more successful it is.
Michael, I wondered at the risk of anthropomorphizing these bees further and they go further afield to find their honey and things. Are they empire builders? Are they aggressive? Are they always looking to expand their ground?
They can coexist quite well, honeybees, together.
That's what all the empires have said, haven't they?
Yeah, yeah.
No, I love the tribesmen. Yeah. I love this.
However, they can be very aggressive, so they will chase hummingbirds away, and they actually will rid their territory of bumblebees. And the way they do it is they're just faster. They will extract the nectar before the bumblebees can get there. So they're just quicker. They're just quicker on the draw than the bumblebees. So they disappear. So some of the natural species who are looking for some of the same things like nectar, honeybees are much more effective at beating them there.
They don't necessarily fight amongst themselves, though.
The bees do, yeah, right. They'll fight against bumblebees and hummingbirds, but they do not fight against themselves unless they try to enter one another's hives. Each hive has a unique genetic and environmental signature. It has its own culture, which is embedded in the wax comb. So if a bee from another hive tried to enter a hive, it would be expelled. It would be recognized by its scent. So sometimes beekeepers want to merge two hives, particularly if you have one weak hive. You can't just put two hives together because they will not get along. You have to mix the wax together. You have to create a whole new culture that both entities will accept.
I was interested, when you took this book to the publishers, were they interested on two levels? You know, obviously, people are endlessly looking for good new business books that kind of cross out of being just, you know, very niche products. Is it because you had the bees attached in a way that got them excited? I wondered if you'd been, you know, kind of looking down at your feet at kind of caterpillars or ants, whether they'd been so keen. There's something about bees that actually engages people in a way that's quite fascinating.
I think bees are distinct because they have nice measurable outcomes. I think it's really their amazing productivity that gives them their sort of their distinguishing quality.
Rob, you're going to look down at your toast differently now, aren't you?
I certainly am. It does. It always comes up. We like bees, I guess, because they're industrious. They're busy as bees, and we always, you know, they make something that we like. It comes back to that Idiazard joke, doesn't it? Do earwigs make chutney?
Well, you know, the busy as bee is not always true. One of the ways they create flexibility in their workforce is that they have a slack workforce. So 20 to 30% of the workforce is idle at any particular given time. And is called up as needed.
I like that. I like to be as bad as you
love that.
I like to be as busy as a queen bee.
So you don't want to be a queen bee. 1,500 to 2,000 eggs per day is what she lays.
Yeah, no.
Andrew does. listen to it, Andrew. I don't know what you think, but a bit of it, not all of it, though, but certainly bits of corporate Japan came through. And when I was listening to it, I mean, you slightly sort of think about, I think, some of the more shining models, perhaps on the automotive side in Japan. That was like one thing when you sort of started going through your list, Doctor. I'm not sure what struck you, Andrew.
Yeah, and especially also in the way that you talk about being a slightly closed environment as well. They have this kind of DNA that's at the center of what they do, and they're not very good actually when they try and do too many kind of weird mergers and kind of collaborations. It's when they stick to their kind of central principles and when they use their Japanese culture almost. You know, that's when they're at their best.
Yes. The one thing that they do, the way that bees grow, though, and proliferate, and what makes them considered by many an invasive species, is that a hive has physical limitations. It can only get so big, and it gets to a size where it becomes inefficient. It doesn't make sense to add any more workers who would be idle. You would bring in honey that wouldn't be stored or consumed. And so the way they actually proliferate is they divest themselves of about half of the hive. So they spin off. So they get so big, they become inefficient, they spin off, and they start over. And that's really how they grow and reproduce.
And does that mean they're nominating another queen then? Or?
They are creating another queen. The old queen goes with the swarm, and they create a new queen. The grand dame goes, the experience goes with the swarm. The younger workers go with the swarm as well, because they have a longer lifespan to help it succeed, and they go with a store of honey. So they want to give the spin-off, the divested, the swarm, the best chance of succeeding that it possibly can, and they create a new queen for the parent organization.
I don't want to go too off-piece from the book, but are bumblebees bad? I mean, I always thought bumblebees were sort of... I always thought they were the really industrious ones when
they're
I sort of...
just,
well, you know, they're sort of big and huggable, almost.
Well, no, they're not bad. They're not bad. It's just when they come up against quicker, you know, more agile competitors, they just can't compete.
But they're not considered honeybees, then?
No, no.
What do they do?
I don't know that much about
that.
I'm feeling there's a sequel, Dr. O'Malley. just in this alone.
They just make enough honey for themselves.
I think so. Maybe the big greedy.
Sort of thimbles.
That's why they're so big.
Yeah, I actually use Zara. I was a big fan of Zara, the retailer, and their speed in getting to market, finding new designs, 2 weeks, getting them into the store. And I sort of compared the honeybee in their competition with the bumblebee to Zara. It's just, they're just so quick, they just beat them to it. And ultimately what happens is that bumblebees have to start sending out younger bees to try to gather nectar, and it doesn't work for them very well.
Now, finally, I have to ask, in your career as a beekeeper, how many times have you been stung?
Quite a few, actually.
Despite all the protection, the bees always find their way in.
Well, I can tell you that having a bee in your bonnet, there is some truth to that. My wife and I were out gathering honey, and she was just about ready to tell me I had a little hole in my veil when a bee got in to my veil. Now, if you get stung by one bee, you get stung by many, because they give off a pheromone that attracts other bees to you. So you start running.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. You do. I've been chased by four
bees. Yeah, right,
exactly. It's really frightening.
All the way to London.
Yeah, right.
Dr. Michael O'Malley, thank you very much for joining us. The book is The Wisdom of Bees. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're in London. We're back after this. You're back with The Monocle Weekly, where it's almost time to say goodbye for the week. Do you want another chocolate, Rob?
Yeah, I might have a milk one. Come on. Why don't you just have one?
Go on. No, don't feed me. I'm going to be on TV. Okay, I have that one.
There you go.
Oh, no, drop my
careful.
Ball.
Oh, don't drop your balls.
Yeah, got it back.
Good. We haven't had a monologue for a few weeks.
No.
We haven't.
We've been a bit constipated on the monologue front.
Oh, my God.
Good God.
This is a Sunday morning program. Ooh. Anyway, which means we should probably see what our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, has to say. Here he is with this week's monologue.
The West has so far spent this month looking east. President Obama has visited India. President Sarkozy has hosted Hu Jintao, and David Cameron has rocked up in China with four ministers and a team of businessmen. Add in the G20 in Korea, and it suggests that the world's economic centre, and perhaps a touch of political power, has moved a few degrees east. China, in particular, would certainly like to think so. And Messrs Sarkozy and Cameron certainly helped give that impression. Sarkozy hungrily signed multi-billion euro deals when Hu Jintao visited, and Cameron made no attempt to hide the fact that he hoped for something similar when he led his trade delegation to Beijing. For the West, China appears to be a much-needed cash cow, a government that must be respected and in no way antagonised. How else to explain the reticence of any Western leader, publicly at least, to talk about China's human rights record, or suggest the odd democratic reform? George W. Bush, promoting his new memoirs, reiterated his belief that Iraq was a better place because it's now a democracy. But his professed love for free votes only went so far when he was in office. He never dared suggest that Hu Jintao should hold elections. And China knows that Western leaders are more interested in trade deals than human rights. Following the decision of the Nobel Peace Prize Committee to give this year's award to Liu Xibao, China's vice foreign minister warned that governments which sent representatives to the Nobel Prize ceremony would bear the consequences, whatever that means. While most ambassadors will almost certainly go, the silence about Liu's continued imprisonment is deafening. Even the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon failed to mention it on a recent trip to Beijing. But the West shouldn't be scared of China. If we care about human rights and democracy, we shouldn't be ashamed about promoting those values. And if the Chinese government is as grown up and sensible as it claims, then it shouldn't mind if Western politicians, politely, mention human rights in between signing contracts for aircraft and other things. There should be a balance to these relationships. And within a few decades, it might not be so easy. Earlier this year, Danny Kwa, a professor in economics at LSE, produced a map showing how the world's economic centre of gravity has shifted east. By taking into account all the GDP produced on the planet, Kwa worked out that in 1980, the average location of economic activity was somewhere in the mid-Atlantic. By 2008, it had reached just east of Bucharest. Kwa reckons that by 2050, it will have shifted more than 5,500 miles east to a spot, appropriately enough, between India and China. For Monocle, this is Steve Bloomfield.
And that was our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. That was a very nice monologue, wasn't it?
He's got a good voice, Mr. Bloomy.
He's got a good delivery, hasn't he?
Yeah, he does.
I like it. He sounds quite classic, doesn't he?
Certainly from the top of the program, you really did feel it, though. Just having the C40 in Hong Kong last week, then, of course, APEC, and then also the G20, it's amazing. And particularly, you know, Robin, when you're in Seoul, I mean, just the way the Koreans were taking it so serious, not just from a security exercise, but really from a branding point of view. And, you know, everyone sort of talks about sort of integrated marketing thinking. And if you just spend any time watching any of the big international news channels, I mean, the Koreans were promoting their economic trade zones this week. They were telling you, you know, why Seoul was great. There must have been sort of five different brand platforms that the Koreans were trying to get across, as much as sort of, you know, all other nations as well. Oddly, though, China was remarkably silent. You didn't see a lot of promotion for brand China or regional China, which is interesting.
But it has been interesting about the G20 is, you know, I think that Korea really recognises a kind of opportunity that most countries haven't kind of managed to grapple with. And they're really kind of keen to kind of start putting their kind of feelers out a bit more on the diplomatic stage. We've kind of covered how they're kind of using aid a little bit more to kind of stretch their wings. So it's really interesting that they really have used it as an amazing branding exercise.
Yeah, and I think it's also interesting when I think we've certainly talked about it, where, you know, I think we're about to see this next layer of Korean company. I mean, everyone has certainly seen, you know, what the likes of Hyundai and certainly, you know, Samsung have done, but there's just a whole wave of other companies, you know, just bubbling up that are going to come into, you know, five or six different sectors, and whether it's food, whether it's retail, whether it's cosmetics, but, you know, just there'll be this second, you know, and almost then probably a third Korean wave as well. But the other thing which there was a lot of discussion about is, you know, of course, everyone sort of looks at sort of, you know, the economic hubs for the region. You know, is it you know, when you talk about really truly international hubs, is it, you know, is it Singapore, is it Hong Kong? And every time you go to Korea, you just notice that the English gets, you know, there's one or two more people in a meeting who speak perfect English, and they've been to Brown, they've been to the world's best institutions. And oddly, I feel sometimes when you go to Hong Kong, and yeah, certainly Hong Kong sometimes, that at a service level, the level of English isn't there like it used to be. And certainly people see that this is going to be one of the great levers that the country is going to have to work with. We all have a story about language schools in our next issue, don't we?
We do. And about the incredible growth of the business of teaching English, especially in China and in Asia, where the kind of market for it is extraordinary. And you can make, if you're the right company, you can make incredible money now from teaching English.
Yeah, we should probably spend a little time next week talking about our next issue. Rob, you've been very quiet over there.
I was just counting. That was the 19th
in what
perfect
language?
Segue that you'd done. So I was just, as you can see, I've got a sort of tally.
You do have a tally
on my notebook
going on there.
And it's a shame, because if you'd done 20, you'd have got a prize.
What? That lone, sad,
the white chocolate
that fell on the floor and rolled around. And
a bit of hair on it.
Very nice. Well, that's all for this week's edition of the Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Alex Mills in London, and our sound engineer was Chris Sharp. If you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then do drop us a note to weekly@monocle.com. And remember, you can catch up with us daily via our monocolumn on our site. And on next week's show, as we said, we'll be previewing our bumper December-January show. Next week, we're here in London. But for now, I'm Tyler Brulé.
I'm Andrew Tuck.
And I'm Robert Bound.
More next week. Goodbye.